ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you logged onto your Ticketmaster account recently? Well, if you haven't, now might be the time. Yes, this week on Download This Show, over 500 million customers, roughly, are reported to have had their personal details stolen by a hacker group. Also on the show, why is News Corp making a deal with the artificial intelligence company OpenAI? And it is the software that completely upended the music and media industry, and it turns 25 this week. But what is it? Let's find out. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed. Against everyone's better judgment, here we are. This is a brand new episode of Download This Show. And a very big welcome to our guest this week, a social media strategist and the founder of State of Social, Meg Coffey. Welcome back.
Hello, hello.
And STEM journalist, broadcaster and previous State of Social, speaker, Ray Johnson. Well, welcome back.
Great to be here, Mark.
All right. Now, if you have bought a ticket on Ticketmaster in the last couple of years, I'm so sorry. You were probably paying too much. But it's also possible that your personal details have been snapped up. This has been a huge story over the last couple of weeks, Ray. What's actually happened?
Yeah, there's a hacker group called Shiny Hunters, which is my favourite name for a hacker group because it's named after the shiny Pokemon, the rare Pokemon.
Wait, that's where they get their name from?
Isn't it wonderful? Yeah, great name, terrible people. They have...
Oh, finally named my memoir.
They have claimed that they have the details for 560 million Ticketmaster customers, which is a huge cache of data. Names, addresses, phone numbers, partial credit card details, the whole gamut. And they want $500,000 ransom or they're going to sell it to other people.
Plus $1 million in fees.
Yes.
Wait, like they're charging administration
yes,
fees now?
It's amazing.
They really are terrible people. Okay, so how long did it take for this to become public, Meg?
Far too long, right? Like it took a week, right? So there were rumblings that this had happened, but Live Nation, the parent company of Ticketmaster, took over a week to actually come clean and say, oh yeah, actually, if you have bought anything with us in the past year in Australia, we believe that your details are all over the internet now with the shiny Pokemon people.
It's an astonishingly large number of people, right? Like this yeah. is, I must confess, I kind of hadn't processed that there was that many people worldwide. Is there any commonality between that group of people or is it a pretty unusual cross-section of their usership or do we just not know at the moment?
Look, we don't have all of those details, but what we do know is that the details of this was posted on a forum called Breach Forums. And this was a place that was shut down in 2023. The admin of it was arrested. It's recently relaunched. And there is a tendency for people who post on Breach Forums to inflate what they've done. Yeah, they'll sometimes make false claims. You know, sometimes they're claiming that a hack is bigger than it is by including data from previous hacks. So Ticketmaster, they ended up taking 11 days in total to confirm the breach because they're saying that they were aware of it before Shiny Hunters even posted about on the breach forums. They were really investigating, we assume, whether or not the claim was legitimate, how many people were actually involved, what kind of details were actually released into the ether.
I know we were saying before that, you know, a week, 10 days is a long time between discovery and announcement, Meg, but is there not like a general expectation from a company like Ticketmaster that they do a bit of due diligence before they go public, where they do find out what they can before they go public? And I assume that can take a couple of days, Meg.
Yes, I think you do need to do your due diligence, but I think that it needs to be done at a speed that is much faster than was done. So yes, we know that in these forums, the hackers are known to inflate things, right? So you take that and you take it with a grain of salt. But these big companies should have cyber teams at the ready if they don't have them already sort of like on the payroll. And to take a week to do that due diligence, it's too long. It should be a 36-hour, 48-hour maximum before you are notifying your customers that all of their information is available all over the internet for people to see and scrape and use what they need it for.
It's worth noting, though, that this wasn't straight up Ticketmaster data. being kept in their own servers, in their own secure system.
It was off Snowflake, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that's a third-party cloud database. And it was one single Snowflake employee information that was hacked and stolen that was used to access all of this info. So it comes down to, which is what happens with most data breaches, human error. Mm. You know, one person was lax with their security, 560 million people potentially have their data available on the internet.
Now that it's become public, and obviously the exact number is hazy because, as you say, there is probably a little bit of big noting going on. What has been the response from Ticketmaster to its actual consumers? Like, what are they saying to their clients about their data? Have they given them, Meg, any kind of indication of what they should do?
I don't know. It doesn't. Maybe it's also me in this that I'm feeling a bit like I look at it and I'm like, that's really all you're going to say. But also in the world that we live in, where data breaches happen all the time, it's like, here we go. Here's another one. You got to change all of your banking details, or you got to change your, you know, driver's license. When it comes to these data breaches, I think because they happen so often these days, but I'm of the belief that we need to have a little bit of personal responsibility in the way that we interact online, right? Yes, these companies very much need to be responsible for the data that we give over to them. But are we letting these companies save our credit card details, or are we re-entering them every single time? What's the personal responsibility that we're doing as much as we're holding them responsible for?
Right. The shiny hunters. Resist the urge to smile while I say that. They have an interesting legacy, don't they? They've actually done other things like this before, haven't they?
They've done a huge amount of hacks, so legitimate ones, not just claims as well. So AT&T, they breached 70 million customers
back in 2021. So that's the massive telecommunications company in the US.
Yeah. Also, 200,000 Australian Pizza Hut customers had all of their details breached at one point. But they've gone after Microsoft. They've gone after Mashable users. If you were in the comments section of Mashable at some point, you've had your data breached by shiny hunters.
This is opportunistic, isn't it? There's no sort of strategy or ideological underpinning to this, is there? No.
No, they're just hunting. They're hunting the shinies.
Do you think from a reputational standpoint, Meg, like when a company like a Ticketmaster or a Pizza Hut has a major breach, what's the arc of winning people's trust back? Because eventually they do, because convenience always wins out. But like, what would your first piece of advice be to a company after they've, you know, found out, they've admitted, they've done the mea culpa? What would you suggest to them next?
So Ticketmaster is already in a world of pain because everybody's angry with them for the fees and the scalpers and, you know, the potential monopoly that they might have over things. So they've got a lot of reputation management that they need to do. They need to go back out there. And yes, you know, people will go back to them because convenience wins. Go back to brand building and show why they deserve to have customers' trust, or why they deserve to be the option, the customer's default option. They made people mad, and people don't like their brand, and it's going to require a lot of brand building and a lot of to get back any goodwill.
I think the problem is, though, they do have a monopoly. They were sued by US regulators, or Live Nation was, their parent company, for having a monopoly over this. So if we don't really have a choice but to buy tickets through Ticketmaster, they kind of don't have to rebuild their reputation, because we as consumers get to say, you know, do we want to risk having our information breached to buy these Taylor Swift tickets, or do we just not want to go?
If you're listening to this right now, Ray, and you are a little concerned that buying that one Taylor Swift ticket a couple of months ago has now put you on the hook, if you're concerned that your data might be amongst the data collected, what should people be doing?
First up, contact Ticketmaster. Mm-hmm. They'll have some info for you as to whether or not your details were breached. Cyber.gov.au. They actually have this really cool Have I Been Hacked tool, and it takes you through this big checklist based on what has been breached. So there's instructions on there for how to secure your bank details, how to secure your email, your social media accounts, and advice on how to report it as well. Also, you know, keeping a lookout for any scam emails, calls, as per usual. And please, please, please change your passwords. Use a password manager. Do not use password as your password.
No, change your passwords like every 3 months. Don't just change them once. You need to change your passwords regularly.
Seasonally.
Yes.
It's like updating your wardrobe. Change your password. Are there any other pieces of advice that you would go with, Meg?
Changing the passwords regularly is a big one. Limiting where you put your information out, you know, thinking about, you know, what you give your phone number to versus what you give your email address to. You can always create a new email address. You can't necessarily always create a new phone number. Thinking about all the different data points that you give out to people when you sign up for things online. Do you really need to give them all of those data points, or do you just need to give them the ones that are required?
All right. You are listening to Download This Show. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. Our guest this week, Ray Johnson, STEM journalist and broadcaster, Meg Coffey, social media strategist and the founder of State of Social. And in an unprecedented move, the Mega Media Corporation, News Corp, has announced an agreement with the creators of ChatGPT, OpenAI. Exactly what, though, will they be sharing, Meg?
So this is fascinating to me, right? So the News Corp has signed a deal with OpenAI, the parent company of ChatGPT. I think it was like almost $700 million to license articles from News Corp. So OpenAI is going to license articles so they can train their AI models is the short gist of it. They're going to be able to feed the articles into the ChatGPT system. You can type in something and it will train the article so you can read it. So I think to start, any money that we're giving to journalism is a really good thing. However, the idea of putting all of these news articles into the AI or the LLM training model and letting it learn from that, I don't know if it is going to give us the end result that we think it's going to give us.
I mean, this is an unusual one because we know that all of the different sort of large language model LLMs that were around, a lot of them were scraping the internet for knowledge anyway, right? So the interesting about this is that News Corp, I suppose to their credit, have at least got them to pay for it. I take your point that it is money, good that money's going to journalism. But in terms of how does this change the shape of OpenAI? How does this change the shape of what ChatGPT gives us back? Well, do you have thoughts and feelings on that, Ray?
Oh, I have so many thoughts and feelings. First up, I need to point out, though, that $378 million over 5 years is what News Corp is being paid. OpenAI is a company that's had $13 billion in investment, and it is not making a profit yet. So it is spending what is an absolute drop in the ocean to try to get a usable product to keep investors happy, because what it is putting out there right now might seem amazing if you go, oh, this was made by AI, isn't it great? But when you actually look at what's being created, it is far from amazing. The output is terrible. Mm. There are hallucinations. You still require hallucinations are when it just straight up lies to you, tells completely the wrong thing. And that can be incredibly damaging. We're talking about these large language models that, yes, were scraping the internet for whatever information they could get. OpenAI had started to be sued by news outlets for copyright, for scraping all of this information. Now it is selectively purchasing news from different outlets, which people could argue have a specific bias, as news outlets do. So what OpenAI will be generating through ChatGPT will contain those biases from those news sources. And then we're just going to keep consuming the same content repackaged over and over and over again, without ever actually going and reading those articles?
I think the thing that surprises me most is that the arrangement worked in this order, right? Like, what made more sense to me is any of the various AI companies producing a product that then they licensed back out to your News Corps and your Nines and people like that to add onto their websites to give you information. Like that made more, but that's a business, right? Yeah. That's like a, you know, that's a product you can license and sell to media organizations. It's wild to me that it worked in this particular order, that it was the media organization that is getting paid by OpenAI. I'm surprised that that's the way it worked out, Meg.
No, I agree with you. I agree. Because initially you'd be using the AI to write the articles for you or to create the feature images for the articles to replace the photographer or things like that, not to be creating the content that then trains it to create the output. It does seem a little bit back to front to me. It was interesting. There was an article that I was reading in and around all this about how Uber has its ghost kitchens.
And what now?
Yeah. Uber and the ghost kitchens, you know, so they're restaurants that just, they don't actually have any customers. They're just these like back alley kitchens that just make food for delivery for Uber Eats. And is that going to kind of be like where we're heading, where these, you know, news companies, they don't actually have any readers. They're just creating articles or air quotes journalism to be fed into these LLMs for other people. It does seem back to front to me.
It also comes at a time where OpenAI, the creators of ChatGPT, are sort of like a vortex for drama at the moment. I mean, one thing we haven't had a chance to talk about on the show is the wild situation with Scarlett Johansson.
Her.
I guess the shortest version of this is there was a very famous film a couple of years ago where Scarlett Johansson played an AI, and it seems like as ChatGPT was looking at generating a verbal interface, they actually approached Scarlett Johansson and said, "Would you be interested in doing this?" And then she said no, and then they went off and made another voice that sounds exactly like her.
It does sound very similar to her. There have been some expert researchers that have looked into the very minute differences in the voices, because it is a real voice actor that is voicing it. It's not a generated voice. Apparently it's got a slightly higher pitch is about it. But
he sent the tweet.
He did. He did. She was approached, you know, not only a while ago, but also at what you could call the 11th hour to be like, "Are you sure you don't want to be on board?"
Yeah.
If you could be on board, it'd be really great because we've kind of already created this around you. Not that
And
big,
then Sam Altman sends out a tweet, a one-word tweet that says her.
I'm loath to cut OpenAI and Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, too much slack here. But Scarlett Johansson was playing a heightened version of Siri anyway. But the fact that they reached out to her and she said no and then proceeded to have a voice, like anyone that's done any kind of negotiation with any kind of talent knows that that's going to go horribly, horribly wrong. You add in a person of like stunningly, you know, a stunningly famous person. I guess I'm just thinking, like, how did they not know this was going to go so badly?
Yeah, look, I think they're just arrogant, honestly. I think that there's a level of arrogance that comes from being the hot new thing in tech at the moment. You know, everyone is pumping money into AI and into OpenAI and ChatGPT, and everyone wants to be a part of it. So they may have falsely assumed that Scarlett Johansson wanted to be on board, but interestingly, if she decided to sue, she might have a case. We don't know whether or not, or I'm not aware of whether or not she is planning on suing them, because there is, you know, right of publicity claims that can be brought under state law in California. So that protects someone's name and image and likeness and other distinguishing features of your identity for unauthorized use, which could include your voice. And there is a slight precedent for a likeness being used, being sued. It was Bette Midler.
Yes, I saw
right.
this.
Did you
I
see
love this?
This? Yeah, the Ford Motor Company, they used a Bette Midler impersonator to sing like Bette Midler in a commercial, and she sued them and she won. So if Scarlett Johansson wanted to do this, she would have to prove that they were trying to impersonate her.
I mean, this is the Bette Midler Scarlett Johansson double act that I've always wanted. I mean, it's interesting the thing you were saying about arrogance. I mean, Meg, my general attitude to arrogance is it's okay to be arrogant if you can pay for it. And that's the one thing they didn't do here. Like, they didn't, and now it's going to blow up in their face.
Look, I think if he hadn't sent the tweet, it would have been fine. Maybe not fine, but it would have been like, oh, does that sound like ScarJo?
Plausible deniability. I had no idea it sounded like you, person who I had a meeting with your reps with.
Exactly. But when you send out a tweet like that, a one-word tweet that is so obviously referencing that movie reference, it just, he shot himself in the foot. It's his own fault.
Speaking of potentially destructive technologies, it was 25 years ago, last weekend, that two boys named Sean Parker, Sean Fanning, decided to launch a little bit of technology into the world. It was a peer-to-peer file-sharing platform called Napster. Yes, it is 25 years since the birth of Napster, which completely reinvented not only music, but all forms of media. And I thought it was worth looking back. So tell me the origin story, Ray. Like, where does Napster begin?
It's 1999, Mark. It's the 1st of June.
I've got frosted tips. It's the day before I turn, I don't know how old I turn.
I'm in year 12. Shout out Camden High School. And everyone is so excited that they can suddenly start sharing all of their MP3s with the world. And we're all downloading everyone else's music and burning them to CDs and playing them in the CD stackers of our VK Commodores. So
I love how like the class of 99 in Camden High were really early adopters, because this thing launched on June 1st, but somehow by June, what are we, you know, 6th? We were all doing it.
Look, we're always finding ways to push the boundaries over at Camden High. And that's what this did. You know, the two Shauns effectively pushed the boundaries of what fair use meant. With if you play your CD with your friends in the room, that's fine. If you lend your CD to someone else, that's fine. If that CD becomes a digital product, can you still share it with your friends? Are your friends allowed to be anonymous? Turns out that's not fine. And they ended up being sued by the music industry. But during the period of time they were being sued, the amount of users and publicity that Napster received during that time absolutely ballooned the user base. It went from like 20 million to 80 million people in that period of time. It was a wonderful period of time to be on the early internet, Mark.
Yeah, we went from fair use to fairly easy to use. Meg, what are your earliest memories of Napster?
So I was not a Napster user, but I was a LimeWire user. Yeah, LimeWire. How badly did I infect my computer with LimeWire? So I was a uni in 99, and yeah, definitely downloading the music, burning the CDs, doing all of that. It was the greatest thing in the world being able to, what was it? I can remember the screen. I can describe the look of the thing on the left and the thing on the right that you download and then you drag it and drop it. And Winamp or whatever it was that you'd listen to.
You could have Winamp skins. Remember that?
Yes. Yeah. It was
and then
fabulous.
Someone picks up the phone and your internet connection's lost.
I'm just, so sorry. This just became it. Like nostalgia therapy for aging millennials. I'm so sorry for anybody that doesn't fall in that category.
And it was fabulous until Metallica got mad and said, you can't do it anymore.
So we know the origin story, but what is the legacy of it? Like how has the world changed in the wake of this thing, Ray?
It's been huge. It's kind of like the early days of all the streaming services that currently exist right now. And it's actually funny that after Napster, after they were sued and went bankrupt, they relaunched as a streaming service. Along with all of the other streaming services that currently exist. They just don't have the user base that they used to.
I was shocked to read that they still exist as a streaming service. I thought they were long gone.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. Like, who uses Napster as a streaming service?
I do not, but I have found out it is $10.99 a month or $14.99 on a family plan.
There's something slightly depressing about that. The outlaw of the internet age has
given
now...
Given to the man?
Is basically just another version of the man.
Yeah,
now.
They tried to go legitimate. And I think that's part of why everyone turned so harshly against Metallica as well. Because Napster was a way for us to go, yeah, you know, we're cheating the system to the music industry, without actually really thinking about the impact that would have on musicians. And obviously the current streaming landscape is quite a negative environment for musicians, and they've had to turn to other means like multiple variants of albums and stadium concerts to make any kind of money whatsoever.
We love Tay-Tay. There's nothing wrong.
Why are you hanging this on Taylor?
I'm not. There's so many that do variant albums and stadium tours. Come on.
I mean, one thing I think is definitely worth talking about is the fact that The wake of Napster and LimeWire did create a generation for whom music felt like it should always be free, right? You went from paying X amount for a CD or an album to suddenly like, I can have everything for free. And we've never really worked back from that moment. So even the way in which, yes, we have Spotify and things like that now, but the pricing structures of those things is set so astonishingly low, you know, to match an expectation of the marketplace, right? Where we're, you know, oh, it's cheap enough that I'll buy it, you know, it's cheap enough that I'll get an account. But the amount that we're paying for streaming is clearly not enough. Like, we know that. Some of that you have to blame Napster for kind of completely reinventing the value we put on music. I don't think we've ever really come back from that, Meg.
I mean, I grew up with Columbia House, 25 CDs for a penny. So,
wow.
Did you guys not have that here?
No, I had the local Leading Edge music store.
I had all of my money going to Sanity.
We would get these deals like with all the music things, and you'd sign up. It was the worst way to ruin your credit. Every college kid fell for it. Like, sign up for like music deals, and you get like 25 CDs for like a penny, and then you're on the hook for them. So we were getting music for really, really cheap. I can't believe you guys didn't have that here. But then, yes, no, I agree with you. It did, the LimeWire more of the streaming music, that did introduce us to the idea of the, air quotes, having music for free and change our relationship with it. Because I did, I remember using to go, you know, with my parents on a Friday night, going to the music store and streaming the racks and buying the CDs. And you didn't do that. I'm aging myself in this episode.
We all are.
I think we all are. In like, I think anybody listening to this has basically guessed all of our ages.
Yeah. But you just, you know, you don't do that anymore. And it definitely changed your relationship. And now the idea of like paying, well, I couldn't tell you the last time I paid for an album, like $30 for an album. That would seem so much to me.
It's funny. I bought a concert film the other day for $22. And I remember thinking...
Physical or digital?
No, I bought it digitally. And actually, the process of downloading it digitally was a massive hassle. And there was a moment when I went, this is such a hassle. I've already paid my money. I should just go torrent it because I've kind of done the deal. And it reminded me of all the reasons why I don't do that. But I do remember thinking, this is the first time I've paid for a discrete piece of music in well over a decade. And it's like, and it kind of stood out to me that like that was the first time I'd done that in quite some time.
I want to pay for physical copies. I don't want to pay for digital copies.
I think that's where the vinyl resurgence came in.
We saw, I think it was around
2014, we started to see everyone starting to invest in vinyl again and collecting all the CDs that they used to have back in the 90s in a physical format. And that kind of really took off. But for digital media, I think we just have this perception that we can get it for free, so that's what it should cost.
Yeah, I mean, there are interesting upsides, is probably not the best way to frame it, but I do note that when suddenly all music throughout all history is available to you at a moment's notice, it has done interesting things to music taste, where I think it's flattened music taste. Like I know, you know, the things that fill up, say, my kids' playlist or my, you know, my younger brother's playlist were not just immediate new releases.
No.
Right? So suddenly they'd listen to something that's 50 years old, 20 years old, and all of music history suddenly flattened because it was all accessible without any kind of prior knowledge. And I think that is also, like, if you wanted to highlight a positive outcome, and there are a few to choose from, I do think one of the upsides is that it has sort of flattened the entirety of music history into one smorgasbord. And there are upsides to that, I think, as well. But you'd be hard-pressed to find too many upsides beyond that.
Well, it's made it accessible for sure. I mean, you look at like, you know, Running Up the Hill, how that became, you know, I mean, yes, it was the TV show that brought it back, but it's making music of all generations more accessible to people. I think that's fantastic.
A wildly popular show on a streaming service made an older song popular on another streaming service. That's where we're at.
It's just what the two Shauns would have wanted. It is an interesting legacy, and it has a complex history that I think we are very much still living with the ramifications of. But unfortunately, we are out of time. Huge thank you to our guests this week, Ray Johnson, STEM journalist, broadcaster. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Meg Coffey, social media strategist and the founder of the excellent State of Social event. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed the chat, and actually I'd love to know your thoughts and feelings on the legacy of Napster, don't forget you can always leave a review on whichever podcasting app you happen to listen to us on. And of course, don't forget, both download this show and all of your favourite ABC podcasts are available on ABC Listen. I'm Mark Fennell. I'll be back next week with more Download This Show. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.